Welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Blake McVeigh, and I'm happy to welcome Joseph Rosenblum to the program today. Mr. Rosenblum has written the book Redemption, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Last 31 Hours. The book debuted in March of 2018 and is published by Beacon Press. Welcome, Joseph.
Thank you very much for having me.
This work covers essentially the last day, a little bit more, of King's life here in Memphis, the evening before and the day of his assassination. Your professional experience makes you a particularly apt writer to author such a work.
Well, I've been a journalist forever and a day. I work for the Boston Globe as a reporter and editorial writer. I work for Frontline, the PBS documentary series, as an investigative reporter. I was an editor for Inc. magazine, which is a business magazine. And I've been a freelance writer for about 15 years. So I've hit every one of the media except this one, radio. I've never done any radio. So that's my journalistic background. And then my connection to Tennessee is I'm originally from Tennessee, from Jackson, Tennessee, which is 80 miles northeast of Memphis. And I have a particular connection as well to Memphis. First of all, my family used to come here from time to time for everything imaginable. And also in the summer of 1968, I was working for the Memphis Morning Daily, the Commercial Appeal, as an intern. And that was right after Martin Luther King was here in March and April of that year. And so I heard quite a bit about what had happened when he was here and his murder and so on. And that's really what was my introduction to the subject, other than what I'd read in the papers and why I was intrigued by that story.
You mentioned in your preface how, I guess you could say, like, the seed of this idea for this book was essentially hatched while you were there in the newsroom and at the Commercial Appeal.
In a sense, it was hatched then. I really wasn't thinking of a book. I was just absolutely curious about what had happened and heard these stories, and some of the stories were pretty compelling. What reporters are like when they're gabbing, and they talked about what their experiences had been. And I thought, well, it'd be great if I could go see for myself someday, and maybe there's more to the story, just an idle thought, really. And it wasn't until 2006 that I actually started interviewing people in Memphis and discovered that there was a book in it.
Well, you speak a lot about how your training as an investigative reporter helped you develop what you call a reflexive skepticism.
Yes.
Toward established accounts about major people, major events, things of that nature. Was there anything in particular about the King saga that you found the official version was kind of maybe spurious?
Not so much spurious, but I had the sense that there were untold stories. There were a lot of people in Memphis who had interacted with King and been on the scene, and I thought that they had gotten short shrift in the books I read. There are these endless tomes about King. There's one trilogy by Taylor Branch, which is one of the best. It's not only about King, but it's also about the Civil Rights Movement. Mm-hmm. And each of the three tomes is a minimum of 700 pages. And yet, the chapter on Memphis, or chapters on Memphis, in that book and others, doesn't really talk all that much about Memphis and what was happening here and the people surrounding King. So I wanted to hear those stories, and I thought that might be an untold part of the story. Not so much as an investigative reporter, although I did approach the subject that way, and that often means documents, digging into documents. And I tried to gather as many of those as I could and really look into them thoroughly. So that was, if there was an investigative aspect to the story, and I think there was, that was the part that was investigative.
Did you find it difficult to access those kinds of documents?
The short answer is no. You had to look in the right places, and sometimes they were quite voluminous. But people were quite ready to help, and the documents themselves were accessible for the most part.
I guess a corollary to that would be, did you find there was much interest from other people in those documents? Did you feel that you were competing with others to gain access?
Not really. I mean, this territory had been mined pretty thoroughly, and there weren't a lot of people working on similar books at the time. at least not the kind of book I wrote, that looked really deeply at what happened in Memphis and when King was here. There were FBI files that I obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request. Mm-hmm. Those had been poured over, but I found by looking at the transcripts from the hearings that by looking at the informant reports, the field reports to the FBI very comprehensively, I think I found things that related to my story that others had missed. And then I started to say I also got the full transcripts from the hearings of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which their hearings were about 10 years after the King's mm-hmm. murder. They were in 1977. And again, it takes some time, but if you go through those meticulously, you find elements that others haven't really noticed, or they weren't able to string various pieces of the puzzle together. And that's what you do as a reporter.
So you changed focus and found maybe new perspective?
New perspectives, new details, new insights from a lot of looking and a lot of digging into those materials.
And so you said in a lot of the different King biographies that you have come across and that you have read, nobody quite covered Memphis in a satisfying way, that they were basically missing a pretty significant part of the story. Was there anything else in particular that drove you to focus on these last 31 hours, the time when he landed to the time of the actual assassination? Was there anything else that compelled you to tell that particular story?
Well, I was looking for a narrative because I think that's the most effective way to tell us, to talk about some episode of American history. And then it became a question of what the shape of the narrative would be. And I didn't want it to be the scope to be too wide, because I wanted my book to be more accessible than those I was mentioning before, those 700-page books. And I think they are daunting for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. They're doorstops, and you look at it and you think, I'll never live long enough to read all three of these books. There's another one there were two that won a Pulitzer, that won the first of those trilogies, one by Taylor Branch, another one by David Garrow called Bearing the Cross. And that one's about 1,000 pages. So I wanted to write something that was more focused, that had a narrower scope to it. And so it seemed like to me one good literary device was 31 hours and 28 minutes, that time from when King comes back mm-hmm. to Memphis on the morning of April 3rd, 10:33 in the morning, until he's killed at 6:01 the next night. And there was one other big advantage to limiting the narrative to that span of time. And that was, I think that you learn a lot about King from a very condensed look at him. And there was an enormous amount going on. So I thought it was a pretty mm-hmm. rich territory that relatively short time frame allowed me to explore in a book.
Well, it was such a key time in his campaign. One of, if not maybe the dominant theme throughout the book, was the importance King was placing on the Poor People's Campaign and how he felt the Memphis sanitation workers' strike played a key role, or potentially played a key role, in the development of that, the planned march on Washington and everything like that. So more than a literary device, this seemed like, even if he hadn't been assassinated, that it could have been a very key turning point in his campaign.
Absolutely. It was a key turning point because he was undertaking this enormously ambitious project, the Poor People's Campaign. In a way, it was the most ambitious thing he'd ever done, even though he had been ambitious, greatly ambitious throughout his career as a civil rights leader. But the idea of coming to Memphis and intervening in a strike was new for him. And he hadn't really done that before. He'd walked on a picket line very briefly in Atlanta, but he never plunged into a labor dispute where the strike was underway with all its complexities. And Memphis is the place he did that. And he thought that Memphis was a stop on the way to Washington where he was going to stage the Poor People's Campaign. So there was a tremendous amount going on in his life at that point.
Do you feel at all that maybe the Poor People's Campaign was one reason why he was assassinated when he was as opposed to earlier? One thing behind my question there is, you know, he always was a civil rights leader, you know, specifically African Americans and civil rights and things of that nature. When you take it on the Poor People's Campaign, you are expanding that to an even larger number of people, bringing in more people who object, most likely angering even more people. Do you think that played a role in the timing of the assassination at all, or is it just happenstance?
I think that's a very interesting question, and I have two parts to answer it. The first is it suggests that you can psychoanalyze James Earl Ray. I think Ray murdered King.
Yeah.
And to know whether the Poor People's Campaign figured into his calculus, his motivation for killing King is a question that I can't answer because I can't psychoanalyze him.
Yeah.
The second answer is I will say that King was becoming all the more controversial in 1968. In large measure because of the Poor People's Campaign, he was really out there. His was raising his visibility as a controversial figure in American life, and he was being widely scrutinized and criticized for what he was planning to do in Washington. And it's possible that James Earl Ray, on some level, responded to that negativity about King and that that might have pushed him over the edge, so that that's why he acted when he did.
So maybe he could not have put it in those terms, but that may have pushed him to acting when he did.
It's possible. And you can even speculate further that if it hadn't been Ray, given that he was an intensely controversial figure in the spring of 1968, then maybe someone else would have tried to kill him. But that's even more speculative.
Right. Well, there was a bomb threat in Atlanta on his way to Memphis, so it was always on his mind, it seemed. Again, about the Poor People's Campaign, at least in my experience, it is so infrequently mentioned. I mean, that's not the first thing that comes to mind when people think about Martin Luther King Jr. is the Poor People's Campaign. They think about Selma or, you know, some other civil rights landmark event. Any thoughts on that?
Somebody said it well, I think. King is either a dreamer or a revolutionary. The first 10 years of his career fit the first, namely dreamer. Mm-hmm. A dreamer is not the perfect word for it, but he was concentrating on bringing desegregation to African Americans in the South and voting rights to African Americans in the South. Then he pivots in 1965, and he turns northward, and he wants to do something about the slums starting in Chicago and generally to improve the economic circumstances of African Americans and then eventually for all Americans. And that is a more radical notion in some ways. I mean, yes, it was radical to try to contest the Jim Crow laws of the South. A lot of people thought he was quite radical in doing that. But think about the implications of trying to change the whole economic system. It was really what he was calling for was a massive redistribution of wealth and income in America. And that, in some ways, even by his own reckoning, that was a very radical thing to do.
It was as if he was trying to redeem the United States for past sins.
He actually used that kind of language, so much sins, but when it comes to what he called the promise of the federal government that no one would live in poverty. And then he would say he was trying to redeem that promise, which is an idea that he derived from the Declaration of Independence, as it affirms the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. For him, that meant that it was an obligation of the federal government to ensure that no one would live in poverty. And so that's one idea that explains the title of my book, Redemption, Redeem That Promise.
And you talk pretty early in the book about, I think in the preface, about three strands. It's pretty much seems to me the thesis of the work. Talk about the three strands of redemption that you write about throughout.
So the first one, he's returning to Memphis on April 3rd of 1968 to lead another march in Memphis. He led a march only 6 days before, on March the 28th. And that march had turned into a riot. He was there to support the city's garbage workers who were in the midst of a strike. It turns into a riot, and King is denounced widely by politicians and in newspaper editorials. And he decides that the only way he can restore his credibility as a nonviolent leader, because people are accusing him of having lost control of his nonviolent movement, he feels the only way he can do this is to come back to Memphis and lead another march. But the next march, he says, will absolutely have to be nonviolent. So as he comes back to Memphis on April the 3rd, he's resolved to save his reputation, to redeem his reputation as a nonviolent leader. The third meeting, so that's two. Redeem his reputation. Second, to redeem the promise of America, not to allow poverty. And the third meaning has a Christian connotation. So as you know, in Christian theology, Jesus sacrificed himself for the sins of all humanity, sacrificed himself to save all humanity or redeem all humanity of its sin. And that's an idea that King believed he could apply to himself, in the sense that his sacrifice, even to the point of death, and he really thought he was going to die, even to the point of death for the cause of racial and economic justice, would have redemptive value for him in that Christian sense.
Well, you do write a lot about King's apprehension of potential assassination, and you know, as I referenced a minute ago, the bomb threat in Atlanta before they arrive in Memphis, and there was a lot of controversy within his own circle about you shouldn't go to Memphis, it's too dangerous, or yes, let's go ahead and go. Given those fears, do you think it was reckless of King to come here under those circumstances, under the potential threat? Was he, in effect, walking into the mouth of the beast?
I think you can make a very good case that it was reckless or pretty dicey, pretty risky. Yeah. Because these threats are intensifying. He's going into a city that's in crisis, even before the riot, which only greatly intensified the tensions in Memphis. Before the riot, there had been this strike underway since February the 12th. So the strike had become very bitter. And also, it had assumed major racial proportions. And so the city is already tense. The riot happens. There's violence here. The police director, Frank Alleman, said at the time that it was very risky for King to come back and didn't want him to be back, didn't want him to lead another march. So the idea of him coming, especially back for the third time in 1968, was a pretty risky thing for him to do. And if he hadn't felt that it was so crucial to restore his credibility as a nonviolent leader, I think he would have run 1,000 miles away from Memphis rather than come back here.
And I found it so interesting that with the economic aspect of the strike and the whole I Am a Man march that has become so iconic these days, he saw Memphis as the perfect segue into the Poor People's Campaign. And you mentioned a quote in particular, "The movement lives or dies in Memphis." Now, assuming he is speaking specifically about the Poor People's Campaign as the movement, do you agree with this assessment? Do you think he could have gone a different route, stayed alive, and maybe found some measure of success with the Poor People's Campaign?
Well, I think the quote refers partly to the Poor People's Campaign, but more widely to his civil rights movement, because he was so concerned about his credibility. It was absolutely the foundation stone of who he was and what he was trying to do, that he was utterly committed to nonviolence. And if he lost the reputation as being a nonviolent leader, if that was so central to his philosophy, that it could have undermined not just what he was trying to do with the Poor People's Campaign, but also the wider movement. whether or not he could have recovered from the damage that was done to his reputation because of that riot, if he had not come back to Memphis and led another march, is again a question that's very hard to answer. It requires a leap of imagination. I think he probably could have. I think it would have been. I think that did injure his reputation, and he was concerned that when he got to Washington, that the same thing could happen again. That if he didn't deal with it in Memphis, that there might be a protest that would spiral into violence during the Poor People's Campaign, because he was about to lead weeks, if not months, of demonstrations, civil disobedience in the nation's capital. And there could have been participants, or if not participants in his march, then people who joined in and who are really not trained in nonviolence, who could have acted violently. And so he could have been facing an even larger problem in Washington. And that was his concern. So it's so hard to say what how events would have unfolded if he hadn't come back to Memphis to try to do what he was doing, namely to stage a nonviolent march.
And in staging the nonviolent march, he hoped to utilize the local Black Panther invaders as part of his security force, as marshals for the march. Do you think he had any designs on, as long as it went well here, moving the Amman and using them and groups like them, other Black Panther groups, in Washington for the Poor People's Campaign?
I think it was something of a test here in Memphis. It's actually called Black Power groups as opposed to Black Panthers. Black Panther was a different bunch of people. Black Power folks were more an outgrowth of the Southern Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. These are young kids, people like, well, not young, they were college or college graduates, like Stokely Carmichael and H. Rapp Brown, whereas the Black Panthers were more out in Oakland and Huey Newton and people like that. He was concerned. I mean, they were not very impressed by Martin Luther King in 1968. They thought that his method, his nonviolent method and his style of protest no longer was working. It was ineffective. And they also were Black nationalists. King was very much about integration. He wanted to bring the races together. They wanted the races to be apart. They wanted African Americans to have their own movement and not to be collaborating with white people or enlisting white people for support. So they were they saw things differently, and they were quite hostile to King. And some of them were, at least in rhetoric, if not in action, sounded quite violent. So it's conceivable that that kind of rhetoric would have inspired someone in Washington, let's say, to act out violently. And King was concerned about that. He was hoping he could show in Memphis by recruiting these invaders, which is what they call themselves, the Black Power group here, but just by showing that he could bring them aboard, as you said, as parade marshals, that would have a wider meaning when he got to Washington with the Poor People's Campaign.
When you look extensively at what was going on, both in your work and just through the whole civil rights and the Poor People's Campaign, the movements and everything, and you compare things to today, we're living in a pretty controversial time these days. Some of the major problems King dealt with not only remain in America today, but many would say the past few years the nation has maybe, depending on who you talk to, many would say we've regressed socially. And some would even go as far as to say that we haven't made as much progress with social justice as we may have thought. Did any of those sorts of thoughts occur to you as you, I guess it would really have been the latter stages of working on this particular book?
Yes, it occurred to me. As you suggest, people were even going so far as saying, especially after the election of Barack Obama as president, they're going so far as to say that we were entering a new era, a post-racial society, and that the problems of race in America were subsiding, if not disappearing. And more recently, particularly with the Black Lives Matter movement, we've seen a resurgence of concern about race, and it's also unearthed some new hostilities, all you have to do is look at what's happened around these Confederate monuments.
Mm-hmm.
It's happened to some extent even here in Memphis, but
yes.
more flagrantly in Charlottesville, Virginia, where there was these protests and counter-protests
right.
and all sorts of troubles. So now people are feeling, as you say, a feeling that certainly all this optimism that we might be in a post-racial society was premature at best. So yes, and that it was my book was pretty much written before a lot of this happened. But since then, it's occurred to me that the book, in some ways, is relevant in a different light because of what King was trying to do with his own life and his own work back in 1968.
So it has an unexpected benefit of, I think, helping people that might want to begin anew the work on however it might be termed. I don't know if it would be rightly called a civil rights movement or a poor people's campaign. Some people use the term the resistance. I don't know if there really has been a nomenclature, to use a big fancy word, that really describes what certain people are trying to progress these days. But your work could be beneficial to somebody of that mindset.
I hope so. I haven't heard nomenclature either, but it really describes what we're talking about. April 4th of this year was mm-hmm. the 50th anniversary of King's assassination. And there was a lot of discussion about what his legacy means. And we could go on for a long time talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to belabor that subject. But there are those people who said that his example could serve as a reminder of what we've lost, that is a commitment to racial and economic justice. And he believed that poverty was the key to solving a lot of these problems. And that was his emphasis, his overriding cause in the spring of 1968 in the Poor People's Campaign. He was trying urgently to do something about poverty because he thought that if we could relieve poverty in America, it would solve a lot of these other problems of whether it's racial discrimination, whether it's poor education, poor housing, general income and disparity in America,
mm-hmm.
And so on. And so he, I think if he were here today, he'd be 89 years old. Who knows what he'd be like? But if he were here today and you're interviewing him instead of me, I suspect that he'd still be talking just as passionately about poverty and doing something about that, and he'd be talking about other issues too.
Mm-hmm. I suspect you're right. Well, at any rate, however it applies today, I feel this is an important and a relevant work, and I thank you so much for working so hard to produce it.
Well, I thank you, Blake, very much for having me on.
And thank you for your time today. Once again, we have had with us today Joseph Rosenblum, who has written the book Redemption, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Last 31 Hours, published by Beacon Press. I'm Blake McVeigh, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.